Welcome to VarmBlog, where our aim is to give you the best in analysis in philosophy, political economy, history, art, culture, and geopolitics from a left-wing and socialist-friendly perspective. We aim to bring you different perspectives from different walks of life and to have you educate yourself what to do with what you learned here. We do not aim to give you prefabricated and easy answers. Abandon all hope, ye who subscribe here, for you will learn, and it will be your responsibility what you do. And with that, let's begin today's episode. Hello and welcome to VarmBlog, and today I'm back with the friend of the show, Daniel Tutt, and we are talking about specifically an article he wrote called Matrimony and the Market for Eon Magazine, which I think was probably fairly controversial, although I find it kind of funny that it was, because I was like, it's pretty much just a list of sociological facts that are pretty much agreed upon, even by critics of marriage. but I think it does bear some discussing, given the discussion of family abolition, the history of that term, the way that it was viewed, say, when August Babel wrote his book on women, all that almost 200 years ago. And what is meant by the term, and you and I have both talked about Christopher Lash on this. It is one of the few places where I'm critical of Lash as some of his writing on the family. However, I remain largely unconvinced that family abolition, as it is stated by socialists today, is either necessary or even preferable, because the conditions of which that term originally was coined no longer exist. Bourgeois society has moved past that. So I find that interesting. You mentioned a book, The End of Love, by sociologist Eva
Alouz.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Daniel here to make sure I don't mispronounce everybody's name. Alouz, which I find was kind of funny, because I'm like, isn't what she's arguing basically the companionate marriage thesis that we've had since like maybe the 1980s?
Yeah. She has a concept called unloving, and it's basically, you know, we could sort of summarize her argument by saying that the large-scale effects of the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s has redefined the definition of the romantic possibility, of the romantic bond, and then therefore of marriage and then family. And it's done that by basically centering the concept of self-worth and maximization of pleasure as the primary end for which romantic relationships are sought out and desired and so on. So that is the kind of enforced norm. That is the kind of the reigning possibility of the meaning of romantic love. So therefore, in order to make a relationship work, the partner, and we see this in reams and reams of survey data from married couples and from romantic partners, everything is about the fulfillment of the stability of the emotional life of your partner, right? This is the most cited reason for middle-class divorces. This is the most sought-after trait for men in heterosexual relationships that men must have, emotional maturity, right? This kind of, and so her argument is that in a sense, romance and love now has created this instrumentalization of the very sphere of intimacy. Commodification could be another term for that. And it's created a certain backlash on behalf of people, this process of unloving, whereby if you take just an interesting example of a very famous book on the working class family by Lillian Rubin, written in the 1970s, and then she's written kind of updates to it all throughout the 90s. It's this book right here, actually, I have. It's called Worlds of Pain, Life in the Working Class Family by Rubin, feminist author.
Yeah, Christopher Lodge famously argued with her.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important book. One of the interesting things you find there as a clear case that kind of proves my argument and Eva Aluz's argument and Jennifer Silva's argument and others, that there's something's changed now in the kind of romance, marriage, matrimony bond, is that the working class youth, when they were asked, what was the rationale by which you decided to get married? What was it? And the funny thing is that they didn't have an answer. They didn't have an answer as to, in other words, there was no calculated interest. Mm-hmm. Marriage, in this goes back to the question of the working class conflict that is present, that I wrote about, present today, which is not so much a conflict over traditions. That's kind of how it's translated in the public sphere. But it's more about the fact that we have imposed upon matrimony, romance, relationships, whether they be gender normative, heterosexual, homosexual, or whatever, every relationship must adhere to this maximization of pleasure, maximization of self-worth, which requires all sorts of extra support networks, including therapy, including immersing yourself in self-help, and so on and so forth. So it becomes extremely onerous and alienating for working class people to adhere to this new, all of these new protocols, right? Therefore, we, in a sense, have lost this kind of disinterest that used to govern the romantic bond. I would call it disinterest. You could call it spontaneity, a kind of spontaneity, a kind of naturalness. With that, there was, of course, also, I think, importantly, a kind of notion of a different idea of sacrifice involved in romantic relationships that, from a psychoanalytic point, is worth teasing out and worth discussing. Precisely the fact that if the bond is one of disinterest, that leads to a relationship that allows for a certain deeper form of comfort, a deeper form of safety, a deeper form of connection and bond, because that defines the idea of the family in a sense, right? The family, in a sense, to the extent that we can say that it's a liberatory institution, I think we could say that its capacity for non-instrumentalized forms of love and care would be the way to define that, right? Now, the question is the bourgeois middle-class family capable of producing such a liberatory possibility, right? That becomes a big debate. There's some folks who want to say on the family abolition side that there's really no liberatory potential within, and of course, for them, they don't really make a distinction between the family as a class unit, which I think is essential to do, but let's just follow their line. They said this kind of, they almost kind of idealize the family as sort of one structure without an analysis of its class composition and difference, which I think is problematic, but they don't find anything liberatory about its promises. Now, this, I think, in Lash's A Haven in a Heartless World, his book on the family, you know, he follows a different line of thinking, the possibility, which is a very Frankfurt School line of thinking, that yes, in fact, implicit in the Victorian family, before it was introduced to the American middle classes around the turn of the 20th century, actually you have the trappings of something quite liberatory, which is primarily for the working class liberatory, because the Victorian bourgeois family was premised on the subtraction from the degradation of work. It was premised on the cultivation of leisure time. Cultivation of leisure time was afforded and was put forward as a means by which each subject can develop their own sense of self-worth. So you see, that notion of self-worth, I think, is interesting because post-sexual revolution, right, that has modified and become marketized and become commodified. And in a sense, it's become ultra-individualized because the marriage bond of disinterest has severed. And in its severing, we basically are atomized agents responsible for building up our own sense of self-worth. So what we're finding now, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but what we're basically finding now is that what it takes financially in order to follow these protocols of self-care, self-worth, maximization of pleasure, providing emotional stability for your partner, et cetera, is so financially onerous that the working class is tending to, and this is a question about the data we have available about how extensive this is, and it's a debate we can have, a conversation we can have. They are tending to, by and large, reject marriage, reject it. On the one hand, on the other hand, because of assertive marriage after the 1970s, which is people now get married vis-a-vis their class position, which is also meaning that working class people are getting divorced at far higher rates. So they are getting married, but those marriages are quite rocky. The other thing to note is that by and large, for both middle and working class people, marriage remains extremely popular. So its popularity, you see, that points to a contradiction for me, because if the working class finds it popular, on the one hand, they're both experiencing a kind of repressive frustration over not being able to engage in the family, both at the level of this new post-sexual revolution, you know, capitalist commodified self-worth version. And they are also experiencing a sense of penalization in the public sphere if they were to advocate for a return to a more traditional disinterest bond of the family or of marriage, et cetera. So they're kind of screwed in both ways, right? And that to me is what I wanted the article to spark. And that I think is probably why people were quite agitated with my position, because it's sort of one of those deals where I'm trying to bring out an antagonism that is often covered over, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to talk about this because I've thought about this a lot. I've noticed these stats too, going back to about 2010. And that's when I started referring to as viable marriage as a class good. Because the popularity of marriage has not decreased. It's actually kind of increased amongst survey after survey after survey. And yet we have seen the rise of single mother led families. We've seen the rise of incels. We've seen so much into that, in that direction. And one of the things that I started looking at, I got interested in incels and like trying to deal with them, because I teach young people and sometimes see these attitudes start to develop and I want to nip it in the butt. But one of the things that I started asking people to do, particularly on the left, and this ties into your thing, is like, ask yourself what all the self-actualization that I keep on seeing, like people say that these incel men should do, requires. Usually it's therapy. And I'm like, that's actually a highly class good. Most people do not have good enough insurance unless they have a fairly upper middle classish job, or at least, even for example, as a public school teacher, which you know, despite popular opinions, is still in the upper 50% of income regions, which that says less than people think, but still, it is the truth. So it's slightly higher than average pay. Most school insurance may include, depending on the state and depending on the school district, maybe one mental health session a month, if that. And so even for kind of the normative middle end of the middle class, this is actually the therapy and stuff required, even though it has gotten cheaper. There have been, you know, that's all the case. But even if you were, I don't know, of moderate means and you use something like BetterHelp, you're still probably looking at between $80 and $100 a session, which that's out of reach for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's out of reach, but I would want to, I mean, one of the books that I really rely on here, and I think I've mentioned this book to you in prior conversations, is Jennifer Silva's Coming Up Short, which is a book about the working class millennial. So it's millennial generation, working class ethnography. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily what in statistics they call a representative sample. So we can't extract from her work a claim on the entirety of the American millennial working class, but it is extraordinarily diverse sample, okay, of interviewees that she interviews. By diverse, I mean racially, gender wise, geographic wise, etc. So it gets the findings from the book are demonstrative and convincing and persuasive. And one of the findings is the idea that the therapeutic, while they're not necessarily working class millennial youth, are not necessarily engaged in rigorous forms of therapy, whether that be CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or psychoanalytic methods or psychotherapy. It's different than that. It's more that there is an awareness that because of the normative turn to self-worth as the glue of romantic bonds, and because of the concurrent experience that attempting to have relationships with other working class people creates situations of profound risk for each individual involved, which tends to be the basis of the severing of that relationship because of economic precarities, basically, what you have develop is what Silva calls a mood economy in which the goal shifts to self-improvement. Specifically, and this is where family abolition comes in an interesting way. Specifically, for most of the people she interviewed, self-improvement involves overcoming the traumas of one's own familial past, because the truth of the working class family experience is that you have compounded generations of traumatic experiences that have to be worked through. This also introduces us to Lash and, in a sense, to Philip Reeve in The Triumph of the Therapeutic. And one of the things I argue in my piece is that, you know, perhaps Lash was slightly off about this notion of a narcissistic epidemic, because now, in fact, perhaps he couldn't see the way that the precarity would affect the young generation, you see? And what I mean by that is, like, my argument would be that the therapeutic is now what we lean on in the absence of the old promises of the disinterest-based family and so on. So it's a kind of logic of, yes, we accept the self-worth maxim. We bring it upon ourselves. And it's interesting to think even of, like, the concept of authenticity, right? So there's a kind of pervasive notion of self-help culture, which is now internalized, not necessarily in some cheap commodified way, but actually what we find is a sincere interest on behalf of the people that Silva interviews to seriously work out their issues, and that becomes the basis of their success and their social recognition in life. For example, one respondent says, if I can grow up not to become my mother, I will have been a success in my life, right? And the recognition that my friends and loved ones will give to me to that. And because let's say that her mother was a drug addict, for example, mm-hmm. right? Or an alcoholic. If I can survive and not become an alcoholic and not fall into the same repetitions of my family, this will be a success. So it's a different level of measuring one's own self-worth that the therapeutic is offering to working class people. So therefore, it's not necessarily a totally something which is sort of imposed or no, people are strategically picking and choosing forms of spiritual self-help therapeutic modalities that are helping them face these deficiencies, these social breakdown of the family, right? The social breakdown of the family is leading to an embrace of the therapeutic. Okay. So, you know, with family abolition, I mean, I don't know what folks would say to that empirical sociological set of events that are occurring. What does it mean in that sense? I mean, another point to note here is that middle-class families that do stay together, and, you know, I'm not necessarily arguing that this public opinion is sacrosanct. Of course, it's problematic. But what we do find is that overall, they live longer and they are happier as individuals, right? So we both see the popularity of the family continuing. We see its deprivation, its opportunities literally being removed from the working class by and large, right? And so these things concern me, and I think that they need to be discussed, and this is a problem. Like, this is a serious issue. Maybe we can discuss, like, sort of the strategies by which we raise this. I think it sparks people's emotions, right? The Marxist sociologist at Oxford, Goran Thurborn, he wrote a really interesting book on a long durée study of the family. And his argument is that the family, even after the communist revolutions in Russia and China, all the way up through the sexual revolution, in essence, it is the least flexible institution. It is the least flexible institution. It's the most sunk and the most constant, right? If anything, actually, what he shows apropos the socialist revolutions is that that is the site where you saw the first infusion of the egalitarian expansion of family rights, which was completely unprecedented. And so what, you know, yeah, but these are some lines of inquiry. So, you know, the irony is that we have a kind of, I mean, this is the great sort of lie of the bourgeois family that has always been a bit of a lie, which is that its promises are very egalitarian seeming, right? And it remains this kind of allure for people, which is unfulfillable, right? And it's kind of always been that way. Like, the proletariat finds the promises of the bourgeois family to be unfulfillable. And this is a common trope stretching back to late 19th century, you know. And I think this is exactly what we're dealing with today. And this is the site of a new class conflict, I would say, as well, you know. How do we make that class conflict legible? How does that formulate into, how do we politicize this? Is this domain politicizable? Those are the questions I want to have. You know, those are the debates we should have with both family abolitionists, but whoever on the left.
The question for me has always been, to some degree, why did the companionate marriage become the standard model, and why is the companionate marriage itself modeled on self-actualization? I think part of it has to do with the sexual revolution, but it is an interesting problem, because looming in the background of all this, and you haven't stated it this way, but I'll state it bluntly, is since about the 1960s, we've seen partial lumpenization of large swaths of the working class. And we even see it on, like, non-Marxist values poll. So you look at someone really basic, like Ruby Payne, who used to do this for schools, trying to teach teachers how to deal with class in schools, right? And one of the things that you notice is the, quote, values associated with poverty, which would be the low end of the working class and the lumpen. You see these values actually become more standard. That more part of the population that we would have traditionally seen as middle class in America not under Marxist terms, you know, middle class is it's mentioned in Marx, but inconsistently, blah, blah, blah. But that conception in America, we see more and more of the kinds of values across the board. Now, I want to talk about this because I think this actually adds into what you're talking about in an interesting way. And I'll talk about Silva here, too, because I read that book after you told me the a few months ago. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about somewhere between Silva and Melinda Cooper and this problem in specific is that the traumas dealt with by the working class and why everyone seems to have fucking issues with their parents, which we used to basically associate with post-1960s upper middle class bourgeois and petty bourgeois obsessions, right? Like, that was not a model for everybody. Like, my grandfather was a bricklayer and a brick maker. His grandfather killed himself during the Depression. I never once heard him talk about his father in a way that would be recognizable to us under traumatic terms, which were clearly there. Like, yet his son, my father, was totally riddled with that conception and these conceptions of family. So I started trying to analyze my own life and history through these terms, because I come from a working class background. I have managed to work up, but in working up, I can also say I have not been able to secure the kind of goods, you know, social goods, that my parents, who were clearly and squarely working class, my mother did the thing that many women did in the 80s and 90s and became a nurse late to kind of stabilize her life. And it did actually dramatically end a lot of the lumpenized problems. You know, not all of them. And, you know, for her sake, I won't go into what they were, but they got better as she got up and self-actualized through labor. And also, my family had a lot fucking more resources, you know, once she did that. But the tension for me is there's been a lot of very subtle things that the left doesn't recognize have been taken away. Silva talks about something that I think is actually interesting. People have commented on like how the poverty draft isn't real. And I've been like, no, the poverty draft has just gone away. And what we've seen is the military Keynesian largesse that saved large parts of the country after deindustrialization has been gradually chipped back. And for a lot of the quote working class family, that was the one source of stability that a lot of these people have. It is no longer. There's like we always think about, oh, you know, the tragedy of the poverty draft. And that's true, but that's undialectical, because there's this other side of it where, like, we had a social welfare system that was basically ran for poor people through the military, and less poor people benefited from it. By the time we get to millennials, it's non-existent. So that out that Gen Xers had, and to a great degree, the boomers in the lost generation have, I mean, that's why there was a college boom in the first place, was gone.
Yep.
And so I started really thinking about this in terms of family abolition, because, you know, I find it interesting. There's a lot of people, for example, if you're upper middle class, you tend to associate polyamory with the lower class. If you're lower class, you associate polyamory with the upper middle class. And personally, going in and out of those circles, I would say that if it calls itself polyamory, it's actually probably middle class and above. Mm. And one of the things that's actually interesting about that is marriage is actually still a good for a lot of these people. So this abolition of the family has not ended marriage at all. It's just made it where, like, sexual fidelity is not an expectation of a certain kind of marriage. This is not a broadly popular position. But it is one. And I think it's an interesting one to think of in class terms, because what that indicates is, like, even though people may be unfulfilled in parts of their marriages, or maybe they think monogamy is too much, blah, blah, blah. They do still see the value of marriage in the terms of self-actualization and in the terms of social stability. And so one of the things I've been talking about this, and, like, let's be more honest about it, is that when we talk about this in terms of family abolition, and we now mean something different than what socialists traditionally meant by it, because one of the things that they wanted was, like, a free love, but that meant you could choose your own partner for real, real, as opposed to just superficially. And basically something like no fault divorce, which we already have. Nearly universally. So we have to ask ourselves, why is family, you know, as you said, such a good, and why is it incapable of disinterest? And I think what looms for me in a lot of this is, like, we aren't talking about how much more lumpenized the atomized family is, although interestingly, in the debates, but the reason why I mentioned with you the last debates with Lillian Rubin, is that I actually think I'm one of the few people think Lillian Rubin run the debate. Because she didn't consider the family as such. She didn't actually, she wasn't taking the position actually that Lash was attributing to her. She was pointing out that, like, the bourgeois family was always presented as their aspirational good, and working class people never had full access to it. And even when there was the family wage through one wage order, it was always precarious and forced people to work, which Lash, like, admits back, but still is like, well, but nothing's replaced it, right? And
yeah.
And I remember reading that exchange and thinking that, like, Lash wasn't actually getting how much Lillian Rubin was actually agreeing with him.
Well, there's also the dynamic of the definition of the working class from a sociological standpoint in terms of what we mean. I mean, right now, I don't know if you knew this, but 57% of people our age see themselves as working class. Now, Lillian Rubin, in her study, and Silva in her study, and many other studies from what's called working class studies in academia, which is a pretty cool multidisciplinary field of research. There's problems with it I can mention in a moment. We can talk about that, but nonetheless, it's worth looking at. They have the Routledge Handbook of Working Class Studies, which came out just 2 years ago, I think, and it's very good. But they're really talking about the working poor.
Yeah, they are.
They're really talking about the working poor. And, you know, they're talking about the working poor, and they're talking about a remnant of the old Fordist era working class, which no longer has the capacity for its own autonomous culture building. And this is the crisis the working class is facing. Is this, I would say it's that, which is why their prescriptions differ from Lash's and differ from socialist prescriptions. Because for them, everything is about how do we, through sheer luck, through sheer Nietzschean force, help these subjects, you know, cast off subjects, enter into the middle class. That's their prescriptions.
And I will only push back on you on one thing.
But the socialist position needs to be much better than that. Like, we need to think of a much better. That's all. I mean, it's a classic kind of academic liberal, you know, solution. Go ahead.
No. I just Lash, in the time period we were writing, no longer considered himself a socialist, and he was explicit about that.
Right. Fair enough.
The reason why he didn't consider himself a socialist, interestingly, was defense of the working class, and he was very annoyed, particularly with with sectarian Marxists, both Trotskyists and Marxist-Leninists, who were blaming everything that happened on the false consciousness of the working class. And so, like, he considered this, like, an extension of what we began to saw in the Frankfurt School,
mm-hmm.
you know, writing the working class off, which is fair, right? I think that's fair. But I point that out because I don't think he had a socialist solution to this, and this is partly why he got so...
Yep.
So contentious, because you're absolutely right that there's a problem with working class studies, because it basically argues that, you know, we need to return to like some kind of Fordism that however is more gender equal in some way. Like that's the most left wing you're going to get from this group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons that I'm not going to go into here, cause I've gone into a lot of other places, I don't think that's possible. I don't think we can have Fordism again in right. the way that it existed in 1950,
right?
Because that's predicated on a whole lot of events that'll probably never happen again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of what you see a lot of folks on the kind of the new socialist Jacobin oriented left. I often see these kind of bland or very generalized positions for a kind of greater redistributive state apparatus, which is, mm-hmm. But there's a whole strategic question of political organization, which is sort of thrown out the window in that. And so I think there's that that's thrown out the window. But the other thing that's thrown out the window is, I think, the more Marxological insight that, and maybe even Lukacian insight, that in fact, what's actually needed at this moment is working class culture building, even in the face of its own deterioration, even in the face of its own precarity, even in the face of these facts that we're talking about. What would it look like to organize within those arenas, right? Knowing full well of their difficulties, their emotional difficulties, their atomizations, and so on, because that to me is more of the question, is the culture building piece as a necessary politicized action to be taken. And I think it's interesting also that, you know, so many people do identify as working class, and that actually is a positive for me. I don't want to lean on a definition of class in America as a kind of reducible to the working poor or the most lumpenized, or even, as we were saying recently, the 15% of kind of traditional, what's left of traditional factory industrial workers.
Yeah, so I'm very much
in favor of that. At the same time, some of the conclusions that working class studies scholars will develop are quite interesting. For example, they develop these lines of argument that there are character development differences between middle and working class people, such as a propensity for more honesty for working class people, a propensity to be more drawn to the family structure for working class people as a negative proof or outcome from this. It's a basic psychological point, right? The fact that working class people experience families with greater precarity just simply leads to their own reliance and dependence on the family form. There's a whole unconscious dimension to that as well. So the working class studies essays and theorists and writers, they develop a whole kind of itinerary of different personality commonalities. So I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, in a sense, it's positive to at least know that empirically those things are real, because if the Marxist proposition, and even here, you know, psychoanalysis is helpful, frankly, that like class conflict actually cannot be made legible, or rather a task of a socialist politics is to help make class conflict more legible. I think that's what we're dealing with here in this debate on the family. Is it becomes an arena for increasing the literacy and the legibility of an otherwise quiet or an otherwise covered over class conflict, right? Which I find interesting and valuable.
I I was thinking about this one. So about, you know, the number of tailist opportunists that I will say who try to pick up conservative values to speak to the working class, because they talk about working class family stability. And then someone like J.D. Vance will write about all this, with contempt about the working class. I mean, he became a working class whisperer and he like claims to speak for them now, but he when you read him, he, like many upwards former working class people. And I say this as I've said many times before, I am potentially this person. I was almost this person, who holds the working class responsible for their own pathologies in a way that, like, basically is a pick up your bootstraps. You guys say you believe in God, but you don't. You guys say you believe in family, but you're all divorced and fucked up. And it removes all the inputs that we've been talking about for why that happened and blames people individually. Conversely, on the liberal left, and this has infected a large part of the radical left, there has been a focus on identity types in a way that does not deal with this. And anytime you do speak with it, you're seen as shaming or promoting socially conservative, patriarchal, sexist values. And one of the things that I always struggle with this is, like, have you talked to working mothers, like, who are unmarried, and their experience of the sex actualization loop? And I'm gonna call it a sex actualization loop, actually, because it's actually kind of accurate to what's being done here. It leads to very unhappy, men, but it also leads to very unhappy women. And somehow in this discourse, we don't actually talk about that much. However, you're right. I mean, I think this goes back to, like, I'm not Pierre Bourdieu, but there is something that I think he's quite accurate on. And when it comes to habitus, it's kind of picked up by Ruby Payne, which was, I think, is a precursor to these working class studies, in the studies of culture and how to approach culture, which are aggregates. And I need to point that out. These are aggregate personality types. You can't actually reduce them solely to the individual, but there are things in that Marxists probably don't want to hear. One of the things is that relationships and casual, even down to the casual level, are valued more by impoverished people, but they are not necessarily, they are highly instrumentalized. And the reason why they're highly instrumentalized is relationships is something you can have for seemingly free. And the cost of bad families and whatnot are something these people have experienced. And the cost of not having social support groups are something these people have experienced. So they will tolerate, frankly, abusive relationships, not just in the family, just in general. But even the same token, because of that, I think that's part of where this hesitation to marry has really come in, because, and again, not to say, like, we have to look at both sides of these things. Like, the experience of a good marriage is something these people would see people enjoy, have seen people in their families going back to their grandparents, probably have. If you hear for, like, if you read the descriptions of, like, family life made by women in the 1960s based on class, and, like, the middle class sees these changes in marriage and women entering work as a big liberation. I find it interesting because the working class, by that we will mean the working poor here, did not perceive it like that, because women have worked the whole fucking time anyway. Like,
I think it's fair sociologically to sort of concentrate on the experiential dynamics of the working poor as most exemplary, because right. Even though it's of the extreme variant, the basis of a working class family that even has more stability, such as what you shared in your example, the truth is that there's a lot of heterogeneity of class, not necessarily class mobility, but class movement, right? That allows for that heterogeneity of multiple experiences to be lived. Like, for example, we no longer have, we have, in some cases we do, but it's pretty rare to see families that have not experienced some infusion of wealth at some point. But, you know, I mean, speaking anecdotally myself, it's very interesting because one of the dynamics that's been a part of American capitalism stretching back really to, you know, the movement West, the 48ers, that whole kind of cowboy, mystique, wild, rugged capitalism, is that American wealth falls, rises and falls by generations. So you can have a generation that is working poor. You can have another generation which is middle class, maybe even upper middle class in some sense. So there's these oscillations that make the mythology of the family this kind of strange, almost impossible to pin down class formation to an extent, right? Not in all cases, but in some cases. And that's actually part of the reason why, just speaking in it, I'm interested in class, because I've seen that heterogeneity almost from a 360 degrees, where actually I have on one side of my father's family, people who went to like Stanford University, they were Spanish. My grandmother's name is Rita. She's full Spanish, and she was basically from a kind of minor aristocratic family. I never touched her money. We never had any access to it, but she was a part of my family. So there's this cultural influence that I have. So you see, it's this heterogeneity that makes the family this kind of very interesting thing. And I think from a socialist point of view, what matters here is the greater capacity that we can concentrate an analysis on the acute sufferings and experiences of working class families, the better off we're going to be in our analysis. I think these analyses of the family that put forward a non-class analysis of the family as purely just patriarchal or purely just one thing end up with almost like a quasi-religious theory of the family in a weird sense, because there's so it's a non-materialist analysis ultimately. And I'm troubled by that. I don't think that it's quite useful. And I think the other thing I'll say to your point regarding egalitarian aspects of family and marriage as defined after post-60 sexual revolution, it's an interesting dynamic, because on the one hand, we see non-normative gay, lesbian, etc. forms of matrimony way happier in terms of like their personal survey responses as individuals, way happier, more content, and more having their marriage consecrated on the basis of love. We see that the fulfillment of the sexual revolution, which really was not a revolution, and Philip Reeve mentions this, I think to his credit, he's right, was not really a revolution which was meant to fundamentally have an economic overhaul of the status of the material status of the family. It's defining egalitarianism in the field of pleasure, sexual expression, and power and gender relations, which are all extremely valuable and extremely important. We have that for people that can afford it, right? And this actually comes down to a question of like how you theorize. Also, this is why the working class is important too as well. How do you theorize the working class's spontaneous relationship to those promises? Do you theorize the working class as hostile to, you know, non-standard, non-normative forms of sexual expression? Or do you feel that the working class on their own, without the mediation of experts and college-educated people, can do that stuff on their own, can figure that stuff out on their own? I would take the latter point, which is a question of trust. Do you trust them? And I think we have to. In a certain extent, to some extent, we have to trust them that, in fact, there's not necessarily a desire. And Silva shows this too. There's not a desire for the repetition of an old patriarchal family. That's actually one positive thing of the therapeutic. Working class people turning to the therapeutic are also aware of the downsides of the patriarchal family. They're aware of it because people are not stupid. They put it together. They put together the past familial traumas that they experienced, and they attribute it to things like patriarchy. That's happening. You don't need experts to, you know, so you see, I'm trying to articulate a sense of a kind of critique of how the sexual revolution was co-opted by elites and how it's still mediated by experts and how yet at the same time, the therapeutic now can be taken up by working class people without necessarily relying on experts. Like people are figuring it out in their own autodidactic ways, right?
Yeah, this is funny. I would like to hear your take on this. One of the things that I've always been fascinated by is the restrictiveness of marriage for women, if you actually study it. Historically, it's one of the only things that gets worse as you go up in class. And particularly when you look at pre-bourgeois families, but in general, it's like, well, you know, peasants could always marry for love. No, you know, aristocrats cannot. The property and family associations are too important. And we see that fade from the 17th to the 20th century, and the way that that is organized changes dramatically over and over and over again, from gentleman collars to modern dating, and also the gender power relationship in that more than people realize. For example, in the even before the sexual revolution, you started seeing a shift in dating where men took a bigger financial hole and families were forced to step back as dating was privatized. So instead of going to meet in the woman's family's house where there would inevitably be a chaperone, but you're allowed plenty of time. And this was true, particularly in upper middle class families, but you even see it in I wouldn't call these working class. This is one thing Lash does that I don't think is applicable, but like basically, you know, sharecropping families, things that are, you know, the closest thing in North America that we had to peasantry, that this shift dramatically changes in the early 20th century and then changes again with the sexual revolution. But one of the things that we can talk about, and I think this is where Lillian Rubin was actually somewhat pressing in her argument with Lash, is that we can definitely say that working class families historically were more communal and less atomized until Fordist development policies. And that is why that's kind of like the romantic period for the reactionary, even though it's also in some ways what all these, you know, socialists want to go back to is that time period, which I pointed out is actually quite short. You know, at most you can date it between like the end of the war and the resorting after the end of the war and to about 1961, 62, maybe 63. That's not even a generation. That's more like half of one.
Right.
But that's when the baby boom happens and that's when all this stuff kind of gets frozen. Then you throw in the sexual revolution and you see, yes, it's been highly commodified.
Exactly. Bourdieu has a definition of the family that I think is pretty, pretty radical, but also pretty helpful as a heuristic theoretically. He says that a bourgeois family is defined by the way that it exchanges in a form of gift giving and value making to the members of the family that he says makes a taboo on making explicit those exchanges, those family rights, gifts, inheritance, etc. He says all of that makes a taboo on making explicit the fact that the family is a fundamental part of social reproductive life and labor. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting idea because he says this is why in Marxist ideology studies, more attention should be paid to the family because the family serves as the first bastion for how the logic of capitalism conceals itself to each subject, right? And, you know, commodity fetishism occurs at an elemental level in the structure of the family, right? And that is interesting because in the neoliberal era, that structure of this kind of haven, this kind of form of exchange, which is still tied into capitalism, but which is perceived by the members as not, that's the key point, breaks down in neoliberalism, breaks down, I would argue. And now we have what I call the proletarianization of the family. And it's a really dark turn. And here I'm talking at the level of ideology, superstructure, let's say, whereby what's needed is a kind of return to a conception of the family that actually is more liberatory and was premised on leisure, on subtraction from wage labor, etc. All that's pretty much gone now. I mean, that name one person that's really able to articulate that and either A, not get accused of being a kind of right-wing traditionalist or something like that, right? Or a Republican or something like that. But the irony is that this is the sort of interest and the desire mostly of working class people. This is what is wanted. In other words, some kind of reconfigured breadwinner type structure, in a sense, is still, or at least a form of family in which these leisurely outlets are more widely available, and that therefore the project of self-worth making and self-making, etc., is simply given more resources, more strength. I mean, as an anecdote, like, I don't know, like, my grandparents both fought in the Second World War, and it was a breadwinner family. My grandfather died in his 60s because he smoked and drank, and he was traumatized at Guadalcanal. But my grandmother never worked a day in her life, and she became a legend of our family, which is kind of afforded by the fact that she had that subtraction. She had that, you know what I mean? So there was something deeply that also that my mother wanted to repeat for her life, but she couldn't. She had to work, and she didn't want to work. She didn't want to work. I mean, you know, she had to suck it up, right? So I feel that there's this weird moment we're at right now where there's something about how we might resurrect some kind of strange liberatory promise in old forms of the family while not being nostalgic of them, while not fetishizing them, but recognizing more honestly that what they afforded somehow. I don't have that fully figured out, but I'm just trying to at least provide some analysis for people so we can kind of make it more apparent at the minimum, you know.
I think we should also talk about another interesting change. Families have always been, you know, very classed. I don't want to take that away, but as you pointed out, and actually in my own family history, I see the same thing. Marriages to people who were from other classes were not uncommon.
Exactly.
In the beginning of the 20th century, even if no wealth transfer came with it.
Exactly. That's exactly right, which is why the heterogeneity piece during the Fordist period, which was not, it's called non-assertative marriage, that's the technical term, mm-hmm. was present. Now, when you have non-assertative marriage and you have a cost of living which is low, you have, this is my theory, you have the possibility for cultural innovation in art and music and writing, literature, etc., increases. The overall egalitarian matrix possibility of the culture increases. So in a sense, those are the ingredients for the kind of culture that we want to build towards, in my view. Right? In other words, it's extremely healthy and positive when you have cross-class marriages.
Right.
Bottom line, I think it's positive.
I've actually talked about this too in terms of skilling, because you have access to things that you were systemically shut off from. And this traditionally, and not to tie in race into class a little bit, but the strong social and often legal prohibition on interracial marriages was also effectively a prohibition between interclass marriages of one group singled out, so that advantage was not allowed to them in any formal sense.
Right.
And, you know, this disproportionately affects Black and Indigenous communities, actually disproportionately affects Black communities, because the racial status of many other groups was actually in the original kind of binary framework of a lot of states, actually really hard to parse out. So we're the Portuguese white. Well, yes and no. You know, like, right.
It's but like bring... when you have that cross-class dynamism, mm-hmm. it's a different form of social contingency. All the contingency that we have today, especially for working class people, the problem with it is that it's 100% reliant on the market. And the market is a paternalistic engine that only generates forms of dependency, mostly negative dependency, to working class people. And so I'm very much opposed to this libertarian. Obviously I'm in good company here, but you know, that idea of contingency is a repressive contingency. In contingency, I mean like, oh, well, everyone's just telling you to just take the chance and take out the loan, do this, you know, throw caution into the wind. But again, as Silva says, you're facing so much risk and the sense is so onerous, combined with the cost of living crisis, combined with the rent crisis, that people are opting out of that. They're opting out of that. And then my question is, in the opt out, are they politicized to the left? Is the left communicating to people who are opting out of this, which is a very radical subjective gesture to do, is to opt out? But I feel, Derek, that this is happening. I see it, and it's just a sense of mine. It's a premonition of mine.
I would say that the broader left, and it's always, we should always be careful when we throw that word around. I've kind of gotten resistant to that word these days because it is used. Everybody I dislike is a leftist, and everybody I like is a leftist by most people who throw the term around simultaneously. What I would say is we are speaking to some forms of that and not others. We are pathologizing some forms of that, like the movement of the instrumentalization of relationships we can see amongst. And I think we need to be honest. This was less common amongst, you know, the working poor, but more common amongst the downwardly mobile, formerly middle class. Of people being invested into things like pickup artist culture. And then when that failed and they had to realize that that was a sham, they become invested in stuff like incelism and resentment and feeling like, you know, they're entitled to these relationships. But when I see what I see is offered as the solution in almost every single case in left and liberal press, is like, well, they just need to improve themselves. They need to go to therapy. And I'm just like, well, you know, they could be investing the time they're investing in video games and this. And I'm like, okay, but why are they doing that? Like, let's ask ourselves for a second. Why has that happened? Like, what has incentivized that choice?
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting to be somebody who's like an older millennial and see the way that young people latch on to your own narrative, your own story, and the fact that maybe I came up at a time in which I took a lot of risks. And in some cases, I guess I got lucky in terms of family and things of that nature, given that I have two kids and so on. But then that creates a sort of tragic reflection on my part where it's like, well, actually, I don't want to be seen as like in this Nietzschean luck thing, like, oh, well, he's just, you know, he persevered and this American rugged mm-hmm. thing. There's nothing worse than this vision for me. That's the mythology that needs to be destroyed. That, if you want to talk about abolishing things, this needs to be abolished, right? Like, that's what needs to be. It's an ideological, educative thing of somehow, right? I think Silva's right that we're in a culture of such profound risk and precarity that everything needs to be gauged from how people are positioning themselves within those arenas.
Yeah. I think we should be, I think I'm going to tie this into my own life because I think this will get to people, you know, as you're saying here about this, you know, you have two kids, I am, happily partnered. But I have been married twice and both my marriages failed. And both times I was married to different kinds of working class people. And I want people to understand that, like, one family was aspirational and wanted a kind of family that their grandparents had, and they were able to kind of maintain it, but their children have not been able to unless they were able to marry up. And the pressures psychologically on self-actualization that were put on that actually mirror exactly what you said. Particularly actually when we, in my case, when my ex got cancer, and then we also came back to America because we lived abroad, and we had all kinds of new pressures that neither one of us had actually felt when we were abroad. And it fundamentally changed our relationship. And my first marriage ended basically because of economic precarity. I had I lost my job. My partner had dropped out of school, had a ton of debt that she couldn't discharge because she had studied to be a musician. And I think this part of the class narrative for older millennials is often missed. A lot of the working class families were like, well, you're the first. We're going to invest education in you. You're going to be the first. First or maybe the second, if somebody got, like in my case, my mom went to college in her 40s and we started school like around the same time. I mean, she graduated when I basically was a sophomore in college, but my experience of this is we were also told by people who had seen, because it's intermarriage, the benefits of education, but however did not know the risk of telling your kids to do whatever they wanted. And what that would mean, because no one had a realistic viewpoint about what like non-blue collar jobs really were and what the social capital you needed was.
Right.
So there were a lot of mistakes made, but then like in the case of my first wife, this is almost like a working class fucking like social realist novel, but she was studying to be a musician, which requires you playing the piano during the summer. But to go to college, she worked at a plastic injection mold in Upper Pennsylvania. There was a machinery accident and it cut her tendon, which means that she could never play piano again. And it was like, you know, I mean, almost like I say that story and it almost sounds too fucking cliche to be real, but it was very much real. And she had no idea what to do about that because no one in her family had the experience with that end of education directly and how to negate, you know, what to do with a shift of plans. Mm. This meant that we started off as a couple in pretty severe debt, but we also wanted to be a couple. And when the economic crisis happened, I left the country and she, and again, to get to educational goods and the habitus of class that I think often Marxists are not good on.
Right.
You know, even though we both have working class origins, I was able to get a master's degree. She did not finish her BA. So when we went abroad or when I went abroad, she couldn't be nothing but a housewife. There was no way for her to get a working visa.
Mm.
So she didn't follow me. And after a year, we divorced because what are you going to do when you live several countries apart? Like, and there's and we don't have a culture that supports like that kind of marriage where people don't live together for long periods of time, because that has nothing to do with self-actualization. Yep. Right.
Yep.
Sure.
Right.
And so like when you talk to me about this, I'm like, yeah, I have experienced this directly.
Yeah.
What one of my brothers was able to frankly leverage a marriage to eventually a stable and upper middle class life where he was able to get a doctorate in physical therapy. But in the other cases, marriage was actually kind of a disaster and or not possible. Yeah. Right. And that's out of four brothers. And I don't know, I'm going to talk about this stuff, but this is the stuff that informs people's life. Now, as what you said, should we trust people on like these non-traditional marriage relationships and whatnot? My implication is yes. Like, I've always thought about the fact that even though, you know, that little Richard, who grew up actually about 20 minutes away from me, in one of the poorest parts of Macon, would in the 50s be able to drive in that neighborhood that we would now call a ghetto, cross-dressing openly in the 30s, not even in the 50s, in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And historically speaking, and I think this is like, there's a certain logical sense to this even.
Right.
Those non-standard relationships were not really a threat to working class people because property wasn't all that much involved. So who the fuck cared? Like, mm-hmm. like it's not that there was an individual bigotry. I'm sure there was tons.
Mm-hmm.
But the pressure seemed less there. And now that we've seen kind of this commodification of a lot of this, if there's a backlash against that, I think it's actually because this is now seen as a class good. And occasionally when you see like people like, I'll just name a name here, Paul Cockshott, try to celebrate, you know, traditional heterosexual families as being more working class than, say, gay families, because gay people have a more indiscretionary income. I'm always like, if that exists at all, that's actually a result of this kind of commodification of the sexual revolution. It is not right. anything inherent that I've ever seen to the working class. Because working class people, you know, for example, religious institutions were important, but not as restrictive in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It almost like, as you said, a lot of the response to this actually pretends that marriage amongst working class people was basically the Christian marriage as promoted by middle class Protestants.
Mm.
But only in those terms, which I just think, yeah, I mean, everybody was kind of religious back then, but like we don't see the strictures being followed that strictly at all. And actually, if you like look at family Bibles and stuff, that's pretty clear. Like, mm-hmm. And I think we do just need to have more faith. You're right. Have more faith in people that like a lot of the big, if there is more bigotry coming from the section of the working poor, I don't want to excuse it, but I think anytime that we try to impose these norms from above upon them, we are far more likely to make it worse.
Mm.
Because it will then make something that is not inherently experienced as class or class aggression seem like it is.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's brilliant. I mean, I think the question is one of something is shifting in the DEI moment right now because of its kind of some of the more extreme manifestations of it. Now they've had to even change the acronym of DEI in corporate settings to, I think, include the concept of inclusion or something like that. So there's a kind of
diversity, you know, equity and inclusion. Yeah.
No, it's always been DEI, but I'm sorry. There's a fourth one now. Belonging, maybe. I don't know. I think belonging. Anyways,
yeah, DEIB,
like, whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, these we're reaching some kind of bottoming out, combined with the post 2008 dynamics. I mean, one, I always like that Jonah Hill movie. The late 90s? That movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's, you know, it depicts the culture quite well, of a kind of feral youth. And frankly, I had very much a feral youth, you know, divorced parents, set off on my own, really just kind of figuring things out on my own.
I had a flat out lumping youth. So I feel you. Like, just,
yeah. Like I've really like, you know, I mean, I was completely disconnected from my father's side of the family. So dealt with that abandonment question, had to be a father figure for my brothers. My stepfather, had a total drug breakdown when I was in high school. So that like screwed my whole college plans. My mother got a divorce when I was a senior in high school. So a second divorce, which was very dramatic. And so, you know, the conflicts that I experienced were helped by the fact that I lived in a world which was non-meritocratic, non-Hunger Games, I mean, my kids now, you know, 11 and 7, they are already interested in college.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't think about where I was going to go to college until I was a senior in high school. I literally didn't think about what I was going to do for college. I didn't even read when I was in high school. I wasn't an intellectual. I had the chance to go to a very modest state school a few hours away from my home. And that's when I became a thinker and, you know, somebody interested in books. But my there was no way that I could have cultivated a life of the mind in my childhood. It was too chaotic, but it was also very free because I didn't really have pressures. I had pressures from the family, but I didn't have institutional professional pressures, if that makes sense.
Right. Here's what I can tell you as a teacher. What I've seen now is the stratification of elite competition. So what do I mean by that? There are more and more people in the working class who just do not believe. And again, I'm using this. I'd say I'm using this more than the working poor, but less than what like the Marxist definition of worker would be. Right. So basically, if we put this in like liberal income quartiles, basically like the lower 40th, you know, income quartile. I see less and less people in that group feel like they will ever, ever have a chance, and they are completely opting out. And conversely,
sorry, you see more people from that group
do opting out entirely. Like
what age range are you talking here? High school.
Because they're realizing that they cannot compete, that the competition has gotten too fierce. The inner elite competition actually brackets even most of their quote betters out, that they are totally fucked. And so, while, you know, I can often talk them or talk their parents into sending them to a community college or something just so they can get professional certifications and some stability that way. The idea that I see amongst them that like they could use school to climb out is almost unheard of. Now, in my generation of like late Gen X, early millennial people, we all thought, since it wrongly, I will add, but we did all think that things were meritocratic enough that we could use this to get out. And some of us did, or others of us used the military to do that. Both those two options, when I go back to my hometown, are foreclosed to most of those students. Like, and then conversely, on the other end of things, and this is not so much even this is almost more of a cultural class thing here. Say something like PMCA, you know my opinions about the category, but I think this does maybe help us clarify who we're talking about. The competition amongst these people has gone down to the point of like, we're thinking about it when we're seven, and there's no, and if you don't, you're utterly fucked. And if you don't have helicopter parents, you're utterly fucked, which also means that the class and culture has gotten worse. And this is one of the things I've challenged a lot of people who get mad at me when I talk about, well, these diversity things in education have not worked. And they're like, well, why do you say that? I'm like, well, okay, let's take two things. We know that in America that black people are disproportionately in the lower quartiles of the kind of liberal class structure. We know that. We know that there's a wealth gap. We know that in America, university has become more diversified in terms of racial preference. But we also know that in America, it's become more economically homogeneous than it has been since the GI Bill. Now, I have a question for you. How then are most black kids benefiting from that? And the answer is they're not. Right? This has actually become an inner elite competition thing.
Right.
And it's actually inner elite competition. It's not just from this one country.
Yeah.
And so this is.
Yeah, it's totally internationalized now.
Right, exactly. Which means you have no chance. Just in raw numbers, I'm just going
to
tell you.
Or you know, we also need to redefine tokenism, class tokenism here, across race, just class tokenism. Like for example, I have had experiences, you know, in my journey, because I mean, I graduated from college, didn't have any economic prospects, so I went back to work in construction, and house sat for somebody in DC on a whim. Got lucky, made friends with a network here, met a professor who agreed to write me a recommendation to grad school. And that's the only reason that I got in. But that was all contingent luck, totally on a whim. I've been in arenas where I felt as if I was tokenized as like the class guy, right? And it's very alienating to be tokenized. You know, it's not just race that they tokenize. People tokenize class. And this is an issue. It's a problem. It's a problem on both fronts. I mean, it leads to feelings of imposter syndrome, which thankfully I haven't dealt with myself, but it's real. Because you get tokenized and it's not good at all. But then the problem is that you are being used as a tool to further the mythology that the system's working.
Yep.
You are used as that tool, and that has to be rejected, especially for working class people that are at the elite schools. When you participate in that, when you allow yourself to be tokenized like that, you need to think twice, in my view. You know, this, and I don't know. I mean, maybe we need to start calling these things out more. It's a part of the system. Ideologically, you have to tokenize in order for its coherent logic to work, which is even a Žižekian point on ideology. When Žižek says ideology is inescapable, I think this is exactly what he means. In other words, the elite schools have an ideology of meritocracy, which is inescapable.
Right. Because it's part of their self-justification. If they drop it, they don't have any, like,
precisely
the kind of contradiction of education right now. And this is even in secondary schools, is like, well, on one hand, we are views for equity, and we want to impart a meritocratic world, even though we know one doesn't exist. On the other hand, let's be honest, a secondary function of schooling, particularly once you get past eighth grade, is sorting the population. That is what you are doing. Like I've always hated the teachers are cops metaphor, but I'm like, but we're not far from it. Now, what does this have to do with family? It has everything to do with family, because now the competition for families to get goods like education for their children and able to secure any kind of viable future for them is now even tied in economic competition that's very subtle, like the fictitious valuation of your home in relationship to its proximity to a good school, which may be public or not. Like, and it doesn't matter if even you get a good education in some of these areas. Like I got a pretty good education from a moderate public school. But what people know and yet don't really talk about is like the influence that your zip code has on how you're evaluated by a college program for if they're going to accept you. And so they will take a few people in as basically like, look, we do this. It's actually more now at elite schools than in like state schools, because state schools don't have the same pressure. And it's actually interestingly led to leftists supporting the removal of things like testing or whatever as means, because they're racist and against, and in some degrees, because all cultural language norms have norms in them, there's almost no way for a test not to be. However, this is one thing Freddie DeBoer is actually good on. I have many disagreements with Freddie, but he's right about this. The class and racial bias in grading is actually far higher than on the standardized test. And yet the left does not say a damn thing about that. And one of the reasons why they don't is that you have to start dealing with these complications of family and working mothers in ways that I think are not easy to fix. And I know that doesn't seem directly related, but it absolutely is. And in some ways, it came to the fore during COVID in ways that made all this very obvious. Like, what were we supposed to do with all these working families who have single mothers when the schools are shut down? And then we saw for the first time, you know, kind of a total dead freezing of women entering the workforce. And why did they do that? Because, well, they don't have social support for their kids and they know it.
Right.
Like,
yeah. I mean, this is part of the situation we're dealing with. I mean, you know, one of the things that Silva, her book leaves us with is a feeling that the way that all this is internalized by working class people is total depoliticization, which, you know, whatever, you can chalk that up to the success of liberal meritocracy. You can chalk that to the success of capitalist ideology, however you want to chalk it up and parse it out. That's a problem. right? Like there needs to be some politicization at an experiential level about these things we're talking about. Where somehow this terrain of experience is largely repressed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is why you need psychoanalysis, right? That's why like psychoanalysis and the politics of the family are so inextricable, I feel. And mm-hmm. even for Marxists, you know, yeah, you need to stoke some fires, like of the class of people you mentioned, which was very harrowing to hear you say that these opportunities, which you perceive as opportunities when you were their age, which weren't really opportunities, they were kind of partial opportunities. Those partial opportunities aren't even
not on the table. They don't see them on the table at all.
So what is happening in this move? That's our question. Like how are these energies being expressed, communicated, seized upon? The incel thing seems to be going away. Thank God. It's a movement of total self-pity. And frankly, Trumpism only accelerated it.
Correct.
He only accelerates it.
I mean, I don't, on one hand, I want people to understand when I say this, that I think we should have compassion for why people become incels. However, once they become incels, I do kind of agree with the liberals on this. You can't really do much with them. You have to shame them because that's going to be, and yes, that will lead to some retrenchment, but in general, you have to make the social cost for these attitudes quite high.
Right.
However, I would love to deal with the problem of why such antisocial, self-pitying attitudes would ever be attracted in the first place. And that is a larger project. So maybe we may have won the battle against this particular instantiation of inceldom, but we have not won the battle on the way we talk about family. And I also, I guess I want to end on this point a little bit, because I am four or five minds on my actual experience of family and marriage, social reproduction, etc. And I want people to understand that, like, I also think that, you know, that the heterosexual pair bonding thing is pretty common, even in non-monogamous societies, frankly. And that our inability to figure out what to do with that right now on the left, where like sometimes it's just completely stigmatized, and for reasons that I understand, to defend other marginalized groups. But I'm always like, you don't have to do one at the expense of the other. Like, there is an acknowledgement of difference that should be allowed that I'm not seeing being done in left-wing rhetoric at all. And this is where I think a lot of the family abolition stuff really loses its way. Because it's like, okay, on one hand, we're telling people, you know, they need autonomy and self-expression and whatever. And on the other hand, you are talking about, like, a large portion of the population is utterly shut off from this liberation that you speak of both genders, but you know, and the hostility. One thing I have been reading amongst Zoomers is the, you know, and social surveys, is the hostility between genders has dramatically increased in social surveys. And I am interested in why that is. There's also, interestingly, a whole lot of identification with LGBT identity, but also not a whole lot of, and I'm very careful about how I say this, because I don't want people to think that I'm condemning this. I think there's an interesting tension in this, but a whole lot of, like, people who are basically still in functionally heterosexual relationships are, for the great majority of young people, it seems like, in no relationships at all. So I don't know what to do with that. That's another contradiction, like the contradiction mm-hmm. you talked about with
I mean it's an irony. I mean it's what Alouz calls the process of unloving, which you can think as an unbinding, an unburdening, I mean, in a sense, for men, there's an unburdening, which can go both ways. It can be perceived as a kind of individual liberation in which you work on self-actualization and you, you know, get hobbies and you, you know, whatever, try to raise money, whatever, right? But there's a void, right? There's still some kind of void. And I think that the fact that Lash points out in his book on the family, that Eli Zaretsky points out, that a lot of socialists have pointed out, which is kind of counterintuitive, is that in reality, for working class people, the family becomes a site of non-commodified living. That is mutual, shared, and is a site for meaning generation. That's just a fact. And because what we're facing is all of us must adhere to this new norm, which is very Foucauldian, kind of, you know, Foucault in California, the culture of the self. Yeah, that whole notion. Culture of narcissism. We all have to, you know, reluctantly. I mean, it's like this funny thing with my father, who's like a Rush Limbaugh conservative who now has a girlfriend who's a deadhead. Mm-hmm. So he can make a pivot from Rush Limbaugh to being a deadhead because he's just irrespective of his own traditional conservative classical views. He still too is inducted into this new norm and regimentation. So we're all a part of it. And I think that the fact is we have to redefine the family somehow in a way which takes some historical analysis quite seriously about how the working class has historically in different periods of capitalist development related to the family. And we're at a juncture right now of a transition where something is afoot of some kind of demand from below. And my question is, again, the politicization question, you know, like, to what extent is the fact that the family now is deprived to people politicizing people? How is it politicizing people? That sounds like it could be a recipe for a lot of reaction, a lot of maybe even right-wing reaction, maybe even proto-fascist reaction, given how sacred the family is. If these trends are really happening, at what point is it going to catch up with us? At what point is this young generation going to fucking have a breakdown? Right? What's going to happen when they do? What's that going to look like? How are we going to seize that? So we need to be in the arena of this. And I think giving people, and if assertive marriage is happening at the extent to which it is, that means that, like it or not, class consciousness is going on. Mm-hmm. It may not be politicized. It may not see itself as that, but it's happening because that's just the kind of natural sociological assortment of people, right? But the question is one of how can the class begin to see itself as a class? How can something be initiated in this way? These are the questions. I mean, and this is sort of just, I mean, whenever we talk about these things, it always feels like we're just opening up a huge thing. And I mean, it's a very emotional topic. So thanks for your personal reflections on it.
I think about this more than I talk about on the show, because I think this is one of the issues where I wish we would quit talking about family abolition, are restoring traditional families or any of that talk, and just go like, okay, we need relationship and family stability. How do we allow for that?
Mm-hmm.
How do we declass this kind of stability? I don't really care how individuals particularly find that stability.
Well, I tell you one thing. When Lash wrote his book on the family, I was reading a letter that he wrote. And this, he said, was a moment. Of course, he wrote the book on the family after having kids.
Right.
And he said that moment was so eye-opening for my relationship to the left, because he was seeing the early rise of this kind of new left position vis-a-vis family abolition and so on. Again, by the way, for the record, I dialogue with family abolitionists. I'm not hostile to them. I appreciate them as comrades, etc. That must be said. And I think Lash did too, to a certain extent. Even though I did catch in his preface to a French book on the ego ideal, I don't know. I'll send you the passage. He did say, he did make a comment which bothered me, where he said, the left's obsession with not LGBTQ, but with homosexual expression is regressive. He said that, which is not necessarily a homophobic point for him to say, but it's Lash at like his worst. But nonetheless, I think Lash is right about this other point, which is that family bonds need to be rethought by the left in ways which, and I've seen this anecdotally with so many friends who have kids, and the way that this kind of transmutes their worldview, but not towards some reactionary worldview that is regressive or for the status quo or depoliticized. It doesn't have to be like that, would be my insistence. We can sort of rethink leftist politics with a kind of, I don't know, some fidelity to the fact of the family as such, and its necessity to be thought and to be experimented with.
Yeah, I, I suppose I think we have to be just be more open in dialogue about all this, but I suspect that under current conditions, and particularly the way we've seen a right really dig down recently on hostility towards not just transgender issues, which I when I say not just, I don't mean to say that's not serious, but that it has been a backdoor to like trying to impose this by force on the general public without any materialist understanding about why this is all happening in the first place. And so the stakes for talking about it are going to be higher at the very moment where it's actually more necessary. And that's going to take some bravery that, frankly, I'm not sure that a lot
bravery
of our
comrades... And humility. Right. Because, you know, when I was exchanging with someone like Nina Power on this, you know, I realized at a certain point that I just don't actually have the qualifications to be making judgments, nor is it in my interest to be making judgments on the trans experience. Right. I'm not interested in that. I mean, I'm 100% in solidarity with their struggle, and I'm fine, and it is correct empirically that they face persecution, and that should be acknowledged. When you start saying that trans people don't face discrimination, or you start to wonder, you know, that's a reactionary position, which I think we must reject in all cases without question. You know, that really bothers me when you start to say, other people suffer, you know, I don't know. Are they experiencing? Can you show me proof? Those lines really bother me. And at that point, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to participate with somebody that's going to hold that view. I'm going to shut down that. Right.
That so far, that's been my line as well. Is like when there's like a denial of something very clearly happening, or like a question begging that pits what we're doing in class stuff against these terms, which almost always, that frankly, when I've dealt with it, it's almost always come from upper middle class people, frankly, where this is some kind of abstract battle for them, of which the working class can be a cudgel. That's a line that I think we have to kind of draw in the sand, whether it comes under the name of psychoanalysis or if it tries to present itself as populism, etc. There are a lot of things about family, about all these forms of family, that are going to make every participant of it uncomfortable. And so I'm with you on just being like, yeah, I can't, I'm going to just admit, I can't speak to the trans experience at all.
Right.
If I do, it is by analogy.
Right? I mean, the beauty of psychoanalysis and its theory of Oedipus, as I understand it and I argue, is that what its position on vis-a-vis the family is a family abolitionist position psychically. I mean, that's Freud's whole point, which is the way that the human being is constructed having to do with the fact that unlike other mammals and other animals, we have a extended period of infant dependency on the mother, creates a psychic set of attachments, dependencies, that it takes almost a lifetime to overcome, right? So like the overcoming of paternal dependencies through the unconscious desire system of our own subjectivity is radical, right? And that is a kind of family abolition effort, right? A kind of a movement out of the, like I was saying before, and this is something we see in the turn to the therapeutic, which is a positive thing about the therapeutic, is yeah, I don't want to be victim to the repetitions and the traumas of my parents. Yeah. You know, we need to be free of those binds. And I think psychoanalysis is powerful in that regard.
In short, yes, therapy TikTok sucks, or therapy Instagram sucks. However, the reason why people need it is not actually a bad thing. It's this real coming to grips with the experience of several generations of a basically class trauma. And
which never known and articulated as class trauma, by the way, but which I would argue would be something to promote, to reveal. It's a kind of issue of covering over. The family is an engine of a covering over of class antagonism.
Right. Yeah. And which I guess this is why I think your intervention was so important, because it neither said that the family abolitionists didn't have a point, nor did you concede that that most people experience family in the way that is largely coded by, frankly, mostly academics from very, you know, particular kinds of class background. And I do think we need to, I mean, I would love for just more data. The data I'm getting right now is depressing as fuck, but I also feel like I don't really know enough. Like, for example, when I hear about whether or not like Zoomers are reactionary on gender relations, I'm like, yeah, well, on some hand, we're relying on self-reporting about LGBTQIA stuff, of which there is plenty. And that seems to be expansive. On the other hand, we also see this like reaction amongst young boys in the media with stuff like from Jordan Peterson to Andrew Tate, where it's both things seem real, but I really can't get a sense from our experience of them as media phenomenon and how on where this actually is located in the class, how large it really is. Like, right. I don't know that. And I haven't found good ways, good studies on it. The Silver Book is probably the best thing we have, and it doesn't quite go into all of that.
Right. And it's not a representative sample. So we're kind of, it's pretty good in terms of its sample size. Where it's best is it's qualitative, not it's quantitative. We need more. I think we need more quantitative social science applications to these phenomenon. But, you know, there's not actually that much academic interest in working class studies, unfortunately. So it's pretty
surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. But anyways, it's been great, man. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really benefited from it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for supporting Varmblog. If you would like more, you can find our stream on YouTube under my name, C. Derek Varn. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe for early audio access, additional shows, unexpurged audios, Q&As with me on video, and other perks, such as access to our archives, etc. There are 3 levels of support. 1 level even gets you on Patreon shows. Occasionally here you will hear shows done with other creators. I hope you enjoy them. We'd like to thank our producer, Paul Channel Strip, and Bitter Lake and Jason Miles for making our intro and exit music. And thank you for all you do. If you can't support us financially, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your podcast catcher of choice. Have a great evening. Bye.